Case number 20-5106 et al. MMV et al. Appellant versus William P. Barr, Attorney General of the United States et al. Ms. Heller for the appellant, Mr. Rubani for the appellee.
Ms. Heller, please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Judicial review of executive actions will not be cut off unless there is persuasive reason to believe that such was the purpose of Congress. And that comes from Justice Clarence Thomas's dissent in Shalala v. Illinois Council on Long-Term Care, which was quoted in this court's recent decision in Make the Road New York versus Wolf. And it's a principle that's been reiterated by the Supreme Court on numerous occasions. Here, the district court erred in holding that 8 U.S.C. section 1252A2A4 cut off the court's jurisdiction to review unwritten and undisclosed policies and procedures because there was no clear and convincing evidence that this was Congress's intent. In fact, the provision cited by the district court in support of its conclusion proves the opposite. In the decision, the district court refers to section 1252E3A2, and this provision provides parameters by which a court may review written policies and procedures. It's not logical that Congress would provide judicial review of only written policies and procedures, but not of unwritten policies and procedures, because if that were the case, it would make E3A2 toothless. Why would the executive branch ever write it down and formally adopt a policy and procedure if it knew that it could evade judicial review? If it just didn't write it down, it wouldn't. And any administration could decide that it disagreed with something in the Immigration and Nationality Act and know that it could avoid a judicial review and undercut the act by simply not writing it down and providing.
Can I ask you a question about this piece of your argument? So I understand the logic of your submission about written versus unwritten, but if we buy your argument, as I understand the way it's framed, it would mean that unwritten, what you're calling an unwritten policy, just doesn't come within the fold of this provision at all. And so the consequence of that would mean, I think, that, for example, under E3, there's limitations on relief. So the court can't impose declaratory or injunctive relief, things of that nature. But then if it were unwritten, those limitations wouldn't even apply. And that seems kind of odd, too, that those limitations wouldn't kick in, even though Congress specifically said they would kick in as to written policies.
Well, understood, but it seems that it could be that Congress didn't imagine the executive branch would start trying to undercut the Immigration and Nationality Act by making unwritten policies and procedures. But certainly E3A2 talks about parameters by which to review written decisions that one could only determine from a written decision, such as 60 days after implementation. So while I take your point, Your Honor, Chief Judge's point that it seems a little odd, we have to look at the clear and convincing evidence of what Congress intended. And if we look at the statute as a whole, as well as 1225 and what 1225 is intended to provide, it just doesn't make any sense that Congress would say, okay, we're going to review what's written down, but not what's unwritten. I mean, in fact, unwritten policies and procedures are rife with opportunity for abuse and undercutting the law. So it would seem that based upon logic and just the fact that the statute isn't clear, 1252A2A4 couldn't mean to talk about written policies and procedures. It couldn't undercut judicial review of them. For example, if we look at 1225, which is the expedited removal procedure, that provides channeling of certain claims by non-citizens. Then 1252 tries to work with the expedited removal procedure to channel the claims of non-citizens. There's no provision in 1252 for the review of unwritten policies and procedures. And there is case law on this that talks about how if it's not in the channeling provisions, there can't be evidence that Congress intended not to have judicial review of an administrative action. I think we can also look at the plain language of 1252 A2A4, the word adopt. Now, the word adopt can have different meanings. I think it's fair to say that the dictionary has definitions of the word adopt. However, in this context, where we look at it and we look at the statute as a whole, it would seem to be that Congress could not have meant adopt to include unwritten policies and procedures. And there's support in that in the case law. In fact, I think probably the only case that's ever addressed this specific provision with respect to unwritten policies and procedures is Padilla v. Ice from the Western District of Washington, which we cite in our case. And in that case, the court squarely addresses and rejects the government's argument that that section barred judicial review because in that case, they said, look, the government hasn't adopted a formal policy and procedure of prolonged detention. Therefore, it can't fall under the judicial stripping provisions of this section.
So I just want to make sure I'm following your argument. So if it's A2A4, if adopted can't by definition encompass unwritten policies, then what you're saying is there's uninhibited judicial review of unwritten policies, but there's cabin judicial review of written policies.
I think that would be the fair conclusion.
It seems hard to imagine that's what Congress intended, that they wanted to make sure that written policies were only reviewed through a carefully calibrated cabined regime, but to the extent there's an unwritten policy, the careful cabining that Congress implemented with written policies just doesn't apply and it's open season.
Well, I think it would be further concerning that the Congress had intended to, it doesn't make sense that Congress would have intended for review of something that's written down, but then allowed the executive branch to undercut any act, not in this case, it's the Immigration and Nationality Act. It doesn't make sense that it would allow the executive branch unfettered decision to undercut Congress's intent of the INA. And administration could come in and say, you know what, we don't want credible fear interviews. Let's just rubber stamp every non-citizen who comes in and say they have credible fear. They don't write it down. It's not subject to judicial review. But I think we'd all agree that that is antithetical to direct violations in the Immigration and Nationality Act. So I understand, Chief Judge, your concern, but I think it's even more concerning to read that there is, I think that there's better, it's a better analysis that there is no clear and convincing evidence that Congress intended to cut off review of unwritten policies and procedures. So I just want to go back to one thing I said when I was talking about reading section 1225 with 1252, 1252. And that is that I'd also like to just refer the court to Gifford Zeta v. Duke, which we cited in our brief. And in that case, the court cites D.C. Circuit Court cases talking about how if there is no other avenue for review in the administrative process, then the court has to conclude that it wasn't, that Congress didn't mean to cut off judicial review. And in that case, the court rejected an argument that Section 1252 barred review of plaintiff's constitutional and statutory claims challenging the lawfulness of a secret program that was actually written down, but it was a secret program. But I'd like to go on to the secondary argument. If the court disagrees with this one, the court can also conclude that both the unwritten and the written actions weren't adopted. And that's because it couldn't have been adopted because the director, acting director of USCIS at the time, defendant Kenneth Cuccinelli, has been found that he is not a lawfully appointed USCIS director. And that's in LMM versus Cuccinelli, which we cite in our brief. And in that case, the district court concluded that he had not been lawfully appointed. And that case was appealed by the defendants, but the appeal was withdrawn. I believe it was a few weeks ago. We submitted a 28-J letter on August 18th of this year. So that is now the law. Now, in LMM, the court refers to this court's decision in SW General Inc. versus NLRB. And Chief Judge Srinivasan, you were on that decision. And in that case, the court recognized that the FVRA renders any action taken in violation of the statute void ab initio. So, and actually cited that provision of the FVNRA, which says that if a person who has not been lawfully appointed takes an action, that action has no force and effect and cannot be ratified. Thus, if Defendant Cuccinelli didn't have the authority to implement either the written or unwritten challenge actions, then they couldn't have been adopted under the statute. And here's where the district court erred. The district court erred because it concluded that it couldn't even address whether or not the unwritten or written policies and procedures had been adopted because it didn't have jurisdiction. But that's putting the cart before the horse. Our claim is that, well, no, you have jurisdiction because they have not been adopted. Thus, this court is stripped of jurisdiction under 1252A2A4. And this court could say, you know what, we're not going to render a decision on whether or not these actions were lawfully adopted, but remand it back to the district court to actually address in the first instance whether or not the challenged actions, both written and unwritten, were lawfully adopted. And if they weren't, the court has jurisdiction. And then if the district court decides that they were, we may be back here again. Or we may be back here even if she decides in favor of the plaintiff. But that's another basis upon which this court can reverse the district court's decision. And if the court reverses the district court's decision on either one of these, either that you can't adopt unwritten policies and procedures, or that because they were promulgated under Kenneth Cuccinelli, they could not have been adopted and therefore subject to judicial review, then all of the plaintiffs in the second amended complaint get added back. And this court should also deny the branch of the district court's decision that denied the motions for joinder, because then everybody just gets folded back in. And that's a very important point to make here for our clients. I'd like to go on, I guess, in the few little bit of time I have left, unless somebody has questions before my
I do, if I may.
Yes, Judge Ginsburg.
On your point about the Cuccinelli decision, doesn't that point depend in turn on your first point, which you treated as an alternative? But I'm wondering whether it doesn't actually depend upon accepting the first point about what it means to be adopted.
Well, yes. If this court determines that an unwritten policy or procedure cannot be adopted, then it would not reach that point with respect to whether Defendant Cuccinelli could have adopted the unwritten policy. That's right.
So if you don't win on the first point, the second really is unavailing. And if you do win on the first point, the second is unnecessary.
If we win on the first point, the second is unnecessary with respect to the unwritten policies and procedures.
Right.
Yes. If we win on the second point, if the court finds that policies and procedures can be adopted or unwritten policies and procedures can be adopted, we win on the second point because Mr. Cuccinelli couldn't have adopted them because he wasn't lawfully appointed. But that also, on the Kenneth Cuccinelli point, it folds in written the three policies and procedures that were found to be written. So either way, some of those claims go back to the district court, and all of the plaintiffs should go back to the district court.
Well, if that's all there were to, I suppose. But there's more. But wait, there's more.
Okay. Do you have another question?
We'll get to them.
Okay. I see that I'm running into my rebuttal time. I'm happy to keep speaking, but if the court has any other questions, if not.
All right. So you said there were three written policies?
Yes.
I'm seeing two. Let's see what I'm missing. I've got the proceeding without required staffing, training, and guidelines.
Correct.
That's your characterization. And instituting mandatory concurrence review by the fraud detection unit. That's still in the district court. Right?
Yes, that is.
What is the third one, or as you're saying, there are three in this court?
The other one is number six. That interrogation proceeded without, wait, no, I apologize. Hold on. It's number one, Your Honor. I apologize. And number one is that officials at the border fail to orient non-citizens as required to their legal rights. And that was based upon an M-444 form that became unlawful and incorrect after the transit ban was implemented, because that form didn't provide an updated guidance on what standard immigrants had to meet in order to have a positive, credible fear finding.
But to the point here, you're saying that was a written policy?
Yes, because it was in a form that was correct until the transit ban was implemented. And then when the transit ban was implemented, the form became unlawful because it was incorrect and the government didn't update it and continued to use it.
Wait a minute. So they didn't update it. So they didn't do anything in writing. They just left, according to your account, they just left a writing in place after it had become overtaken by events and therefore misleading. And you're calling that a written policy?
Yes. It was a written policy that was lawful until the time that it was not, which was after the transit ban was implemented.
Is there somewhere a written policy that says continue using this outdated form?
We don't know, because there was very limited discovery produced. But to our knowledge, we don't have knowledge one way or the other.
And
it was continued to be used. We do know that.
You're not alleging there was a written directive to keep using the outdated form? You haven't alleged that?
No, I don't think so. I can go back and look at the complaint, but based upon my recollection, we did not allege there was a written form.
That seems to me like an unwritten situation that you've described. But okay, I've got your understanding.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Heller. Unless my colleagues have further questions, we'll hear from the government and we'll give you some rebuttal time. Mr. Ravenny.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Aaron Ravenny for the defendants. Your Honors, although there's a lot of paper and a lot of procedural history in this case, this is really boils down to two basic premises, both found by the district court and both that should be affirmed on appeal. One legal, one factual. And the first, and which you've been discussing with Ms. Heller, is does this statute, which severely circumscribes, for lack of a better word, judicial review of anything having anything to do with the expedited removal statute, does it require a written policy guideline, et cetera, under 1252E3? I mean, the answer, not just as the district court found, but as this court found in American Immigration Lawyers Affairs, and as every district court to address a similar issue since, relying on AILA, has found, that's the answer. The answer is yes. It must be reduced to writing. If it's not reduced to writing in some sort of formal document, it's something different. It's an as-applied challenge. It can be raised in a very, very limited review provision, 1252E2. It doesn't really allow for these sorts of claims, or it's a failure to follow.
What do you do with the situation that Ms. Heller was alluding to in her argument? So suppose you have, I'm not saying that this would actually happen. I'm not saying that this has happened. I'm just giving you a hypothetical. But suppose you have a situation in which agency officials say, I want to make sure that everybody, all officers in the field, undertake review in the following circumscribed way. But if I put it in writing, it's going to be subject to judicial review. So this is just an edict that I would like, and you do it by video conference, you just disseminate it and say, I would like to make sure that everybody operates in the following way. Everybody, this is a generally applicable policy, but I'm not going to reduce it to writing. And if you don't operate in this way, then you're going to be in trouble with me.
I guess the upshot of your position
is that's not subject to judicial review, even though it is a policy. There is such a thing as an unwritten policy, I think you would admit. And so if it's an unwritten policy of that variety, it's just not subject to judicial review.
Well, I think I have a couple of responses to that, Your Honor. I would first resist the premise a little bit. I take the point of the hypothetical, and I want to engage with the hypothetical, but that's definitely not what is presented in this case. We have...
Right, I bake that in. So I know that it's not... I know that your position is it's not what's presented in this case. I get that. I'm just trying to understand the implications of your argument. And let's just assume a hypothetical that I know you would never assume, and I totally understand that. I've worked in the government. I understand what you're saying. But let's just, for purposes of understanding the parameters of the government's submission about the scope of judicial review, I just want to make sure that I'm properly understanding it, that in that hypothetical where somebody says, purely for the purposes of avoiding judicial review, I want to disseminate this policy orally. That's immune to judicial review.
Taking your hypothetical on its face with the caveats built in. Look, that may be a closer question in certain circumstances. If there's evidence, let's say someone, here's an extreme example. Someone says at the credible fear interview to an individual, you know what, I've been told we have a policy that we don't accept anyone from Asia anymore, so denied. That would be strong circumstantial evidence that maybe there is something going on there that could be further looked into. And then maybe there's some in this new case, there's some way to look at the word written and say, well, written doesn't just mean written in this limited extreme circumstance. In this
So can I just stop you right there? Why? If we're assuming that it's unwritten and you're totally understandably relying on the word written, then is the way you read the statute that it's limited to written policies unless it's an unwritten policy that's in fact a policy?
No, Your Honor. I think you'd have a different claim there. You this is sort of like, I refer the court to the rescission, for example, where it had a footnote where it said, look, there's no review of anything raised in this is the recent Supreme Court case on 1252E2, the sister provision. There's no judicial review of anything. No constitutional claims, no legal claims, nothing. And the allegation in that case was, well, you didn't follow this policy or you misapplied the standard. Like a lot of similar claims actually that we're seeing in this case. And the court said, sorry, it's barred, period. Written or unwritten, doesn't matter. Different provision, of course, doesn't use the word written, but it has a footnote that says, look, if we have an extreme example, this is where Justice Alito is responding to Justice Brian Kearns and the concerns to create a horrible footnote, I'll call it. Someone is discriminating against someone on the basis of religion. The example there was Judaism. Well, that might be an example of you have a claim, not that there's jurisdiction to review under the statute is written, but that the statute is written on its face violates that constitutional provision in that circumstance. And of course, there would be other issues. It'd be the 60-day time bar with respect to that sort of claim. But that would be the way that there is potentially an avenue to challenge that extreme policy you've identified in your hypothetical, or I've identified in responding to your hypothetical. But here, and also in AILA, in district court decisions like LMM, the gender, which we cite in our briefs, we had all these same claims. Look, the officers are going off the permitted scope of their discretion. They're applying things ad hoc. Therefore, there must be a secret policy, or therefore there must be a failure to act consistent with written policy. And this court,
So I understand then, if we put aside the constitutional claim that's equal protection based on the policy itself, in your view, and I totally understand this is the reading of the statute, I just want to make sure that it is, if we put to one side an equal protection claim based on the parameters of the particular policy at issue, if the government decides to adopt a policy but not reduce it to writing precisely to avoid judicial review, that works. That's actually a way to avoid judicial review, is to make sure the policy isn't written down.
Look, I think the clear textual answer and the answer that I need to say in defending the statute is yes, correct. If that were in fact what the government were doing, and there was sufficient evidence to show that the government were doing that, that statute as written would bar review. But again, I know it's baked into the hypotheticals, not the case here at all. The plaintiffs had ample opportunity through anecdotal evidence. They have declarations from numerous attorneys on the ground who are very well versed in how these credible fear interviews go. We've got our individual who runs the asylum, our officer who runs the asylum division, two declarations, so somewhere around 300 pages of declarations and exhibits and so forth. And I think the court rightly found, looking at each and every one of the policies, at least that Judge Jackson found were not written, that's numbers 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 10, and 11. At best, all I see here, and the plaintiffs have had ample opportunity to show me otherwise, are as applied ad hoc instances that are not subject to judicial review. And if they wanted to bring a sort of as applied challenge, the way they would do that is simply they would use the vehicle that was rejected in the rescission, other than that footnote I just mentioned, as the extreme sort of constitutional reservation clause. But here, and I didn't hear Ms. Heller discuss this, but even if she's putting aside the legal questions, like under this court's clear precedent, there's got to be clear error. got to be something more than, well, different people could disagree. Maybe if I looked at this evidence, I would have found something slightly different. The judge's decision below is 44 pages. It's extensive. It looks through all the relevant evidence, and I see no basis in the record. I don't see any basis in plaintiff's papers to find clear error. But anyway, to the point on written and as implied, AILA says that. I know the Seventh Circuit has echoed AILA on that. Okay, I'm for American Immigration Lawyers Affairs here. Unwritten or as applied can't be reviewed. Of course, they've identified the concern that you raised, Chief Judge, and this is just not that case. We haven't seen that case yet. Every court below, Judge Moss has had a case, Judge Mehta has had a case, Judge Cooper has had a case. They've all found need a writing, at least on facts under those alleged here. Turning for a minute to the time bar issue, there are potentially, it's not clear, the government admitted below that policies as framed by plaintiffs are not actual policies that exist, but we identified or declared and identified three potential policies, which the district court referred to as challenge actions 1, 6, and 2. I'm going out of order there for a reason. Challenge actions 1 and 6 actually were challenged in LMM, the case before it, Judge Moss, that Heller just referred to. As to challenge action number 1, Judge Moss found it was an unwritten policy, which is the form issue. It was the same claim there that they stopped doing in-person orientation, and there should have been some update in light of the transit rule. They're actually separate policies. They're not related to each other. And Judge Moss actually found that policy to be unwritten and just dismissed it with all the same concerns and arguments that have been raised here on that score. Challenge action number 6 was the memo that was set aside in LMM. That's Cuccinelli's direction that consultation time for individuals in credible fear interview be reduced from 48 to 24 hours. That's set aside. And I believe the district court here identified this. Plaintiffs say they're not challenging that. So they sort of waived that claim anyway. So they must be referring to some other consultation policy. We didn't identify one or declare it as such a different policy. But in any event,
can I ask you on timeliness? Can I ask you about challenge action 9? Because that's the one that everybody agrees, at least as to some plaintiffs, it's still pending in the district court. And
yes, sir.
My question is about the time limit period and whether it's jurisdictional, because as I understand the landscape on this issue, if the time limit is non-jurisdictional, then there's at least a possibility of equitable tolling. And your submission is that there's no possibility of equitable tolling because the time limit is jurisdictional. And I just want to ask you about that because as you well know, under the Supreme Court's decisions in this area, the basic understanding is that time limits are not jurisdictional unless there's a clear statement that it indicates that they are jurisdictional. And I'm wondering if we have the requisite clear statement here, even though the time limit at issue is embedded within what's otherwise a jurisdictional limiting set of provisions, we still have decisions, and the Supreme Court does too, that even if you have provisions that deal with time limits and provisions that deal with jurisdiction that are within the same set of provisions or even within the same sentence, that's the Byers decision from our court, that doesn't necessarily mean that the time limit is jurisdictional. It can still be non-jurisdictional unless there's a condition. And so I'm wondering whether this is a case like Myers in which even though there's proximity between jurisdiction and time limit, that the time limit nonetheless is non-jurisdictional.
Understood, Your Honor. Just a couple of responses. First, precedent, and then actually first principles to respond to your question. But this exact claim was raised in AILA and affirmed in full on that point by the court in AILA. And I don't think there's any argument that AILA's decision has been so eroded by subsequent precedent from the Supreme Court. I certainly didn't see plaintiffs make this argument, that AILA can just be ignored, particularly by district courts.
In AILA, and I'll just ask you to put it to one side anyway, but just for arguments purposes, but I appreciate the point. We have to be obviously cognizant of our precedents. I mean, our court did devote one sentence to this complex of issues and says that it's affirming substantially for the reasons stated by the district court. So there could be a question as to whether that's a holding as to every particular that the district court reached. But in any event, if I could just ask you for these purposes, just to put it to one side, understanding full well that there's an argument about precedent there. just on first principles, so, you put it.
Absolutely. We laid aside that brief a little bit, but having to expand on it here. There's a couple Supreme Court decisions that I think are relevant in this space. Quiet Fund, 575 U.S. 412, and Arbaugh, 2006, which both deal with this issue. And they, to some extent, distinguish between, for example, clearly jurisdictional time limitations and then court-created sort of or claim processing limitations. And this isn't a claim processing limitation. Plaintiffs don't argue that it is, so I think that line of those cases is not relevant here. What's relevant is it expressly conditioned? Can we take a look at the statute as written and find it to be conditioned? I think we absolutely can. You take a look at 1252A2A, which is the more general. There shall be no jurisdiction to review unless XYZ statute. And then it cross-references 1252E in the relevant subsections of that statute that are issued here, 1252A2A4, and we think also 1252A2A1, and then goes to 1252E3 and says there shall be the first statute that you mentioned earlier, Chief Judge, 1252A1, there shall be no jurisdiction to issue any sort of relief other than as permitted in a subsequent provision. And now you have a second jurisdiction conditioned if the conditions that follow are satisfied. Then you have 1252E2 issue here. 1252E3 then says limited judicial review of regulations, written policies, et cetera, but only if they are filed within 60 days in the District Court for the District of Columbia. So we would submit that return of jurisdiction is expressly conditioned on it being done within 60 days. And then there's a good reason for why Congress would want to make that jurisdictional and not allow for tolling. The whole purpose of
where is but only if? You said, but only if. I mean, is that just your paraphrasing, or is that actually?
I'm not quoting, but only if. My apologies, Ron. I'm saying
that seems pretty important because in Myers, for example, that exact word "if" was highlighted by our decision as missing from the statute at issue in Myers, and understanding that if the word "if" was in the statute, that would obviously be expressly conditional. And so the question is,
I think there's a difference
in the same way.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, Your Honor. There's must be filed within. And that's there in 1252B, must be filed no later than. That's not if and only if, but that must be.
But that must be is mandatory. And the one thing we know from the Supreme Court's decisions and Myers is that merely because the statute of limitations is mandatory doesn't mean that it's jurisdictional. That's just run-of-the-mill fare for statute of limits. So I think where you were going was that there one way to show that it's jurisdictional is to show that the statute of limits is conditional. And I'm just wondering if this statute does that.
I think I'm out of my time, but to answer this question, we believe so, yes, because in addition to what I've just said, again, the threshold, the general opening statute is there is no jurisdiction, period, full stop, right, unless you satisfy these conditions. So that's jurisdictional. You then have the first statute in the subsection saying you can only issue any sort of relief if the following conditions are satisfied. Condition doesn't use the word condition. I'll give you, I'd agree with that, but as structured and read naturally, 1252E1's clause saying you have jurisdiction to issue some sort of relief is conditioned on either E2 or E3, those conditions being met. And so one of those conditions for a systemic facial type challenge like that raised by plaintiffs here, you bring it within 60 days. And on that point also, I take the point, I know we're putting aside the precedent and the brief treatment of it in AILA, but every district court that has faced this exact argument also, equitable tolling, the sea is shifting on whether jurisdiction can be a loose or a tight word under the Supreme Court, the gender, LLM, Dugdale, which we cite in our briefs, all address this. The gender, I think, is the most careful and thorough and also most recent decision. It's just from last year from Judge Mehta that goes through all these points and makes many of the same arguments I'm making here. And so that, at the end of the day, it is still a jurisdictional provision. We have precedent on that from this circuit, and that's just how the courts have been applying it. And I don't know that there's enough here to just jettison that at this point, the plaintiffs, at least to say that the district court got this wrong. I'm out of time. If there are no other questions, thank you, Robert.
Thank you for your submission, Mr. Ravani. Ms. Heller, we'll give you 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Thank you. Chief Judge, I'd like to start on the point that you were raising with Mr. Ravani, and obviously I would agree that this statute doesn't meet the high bar to be considered a jurisdictional deadline. But even if it is, and I think this is a really important point that should not be lost, the district court in AILA held that a statutory guideline that's jurisdictional, you can't apply Rule 15, there can be no relation back. I question as to whether or not that's the law. The two cases cited in the district court decision in A law, Lamb versus United States Postal Service and Resolution Trust Corp versus Olson, aren't on point. In fact, Lamb, the court actually performs an analysis as to whether Rule 15 applied and found that it did apply. And I believe in that case ended up not accepting the amendment for other reasons, but at least went through the Rule 15 analysis. More importantly, the Fifth and Seventh Circuits have held that a jurisdictional requirement is satisfied by the timely filing of a suit, and Rule 15 can still apply. And that's Wadsworth, the United States Postal Service, 511 F. 2nd, 64, Seventh Circuit, 1975, and Watkins v. Lujan, 922 F. 2nd, 261, Fifth Circuit, 1991. So any way you cut it, the district court erred in not conducting the Rule 15 analysis as to whether or not the claims made by the plaintiffs in the second amended complaint related back, and also the same analysis for the plaintiffs who attempted to join the litigation. There are two other points I just want to address that Mr. Rubeni addressed. Mr. Rubeni talked about the fact that, you know, this is a review that you have to give great deference to the court on when it comes to unwritten policies and procedures. It's not. This is a de novo review about what the law is. The district court itself conceded and admitted that the facts amassed by the plaintiffs are deeply troubling. The district court suggested there are unwritten policies and procedures. There wasn't a finding that there weren't. The finding by the district court was that the unwritten policies and procedures cannot be reviewed under the relevant statute. Not that they don't exist. That's something the district court didn't meet. And Mr. Rivani's suggestion that our unwritten policies and procedures weren't good enough, weren't egregious enough to rise to the level worthy of review is just not the district court's decision. And that's a question of fact the district court has to address and is required to accept the allegations in the second amended complaint. And there are many about the universal application of unwritten policies and procedures. And lastly, the cases cited by Mr. Rivani to this court and in the brief that say can't review unwritten policies and procedures in AILA and LMM, they're all talking about E3. We're not. The plaintiff's argument is that 1252A2A4 from the get-go does not strip this court of jurisdiction to review unwritten policies and procedures. And whether the court accepts that adoption couldn't have meant unwritten or that defendant Cuccinelli could not have adopted unwritten or written, this has to get remanded back to the district court and reversed. If there are no more questions.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsels. We appreciate your submissions. The case is submitted.
Thank you.